A big Monday, August 19th, to kick off the new week. We talked about Medicare for All. What does that really mean in the sense of a presidential campaign? And would it work here in the U.S.? We chatted with an expert on that. Patrick Sasser joined us later in the show from notollsct.org to update what he's hearing as to whether or not tolls will eventually come up for a vote this calendar year in the General Assembly. And then in the 5 o'clock hour, Quinnipiac University Professor Rich Handley joined us on the 64th anniversary of the Great Flood of 1955. Rich produced a documentary for CPTV on that several years ago. It's still a widely seen documentary. He talked about researching that Great Flood.
Listening to Connecticut Today with Paul Vaselli on WICC 600.
And a lot of people always talk about Medicare for All, Medicare for All. What is it? We do know it's a big plank on the Democratic White House platform by a lot of folks, so we thought we would invite an expert on it today, on Connecticut Today, to chat about it with you. We welcome Yale law grad Dr. Roger Klein, who's also a member of the Regulatory Transparency Project on Healthcare and a former advisor to the FDA and the HHS Department. Dr. Klein, how are you? Paul here on WICC. How are you?
Good. Hi, Paul. Thank you for having me on.
Well, you wrote a recent piece here that appeared in The Hill, and I know you've wrote recent pieces on it that have appeared in various areas regarding this. When we hear candidates, Dr. Klein, talk about health, we talk about Medicare for All. What, first of all, what are they speaking about here? What are they proposing?
Well, I think that it's a little sleight of hand in terms of the wording. It's not really Medicare for All. In fact, what it does is it gets rid of Medicare and replaces Medicare with a universal program that would cover everybody. And in contrast to Medicare, which actually has significant individual contributions both now and throughout a person's lifetime, what Democrats are proposing is to give everything to everybody for free. It's not Medicare, and it's really a single payer system that's much more extensive than Medicare and doesn't have some of the controls and the personal contributions that Medicare has.
What controls, doctor, for example, does Medicare have? Because I know there's a common misconception out there that's been knocked down by people I know and healthcare professionals I know that, well, Medicare will just pay for everything. They'll cover everything. They don't have to worry about money. But you say there are actually Medicare controls that are in place.
Oh, yes. There's a lot of services Medicare doesn't cover. That's the first thing. Secondly, most people who have Medicare, so you have Medicare Part A, which is hospital, and Part B, which is physician. Mm-hmm. Most people need to supplement that to take care of co-payments with what's called a Medigap policy. So people in traditional Medicare will buy a Medigap policy. There's also an alternative, an HMO-type structure that's called Medicare Advantage, and that would cover more, actually, than standard Medicare with a Medigap policy. But on the other hand, there are more restrictions and controls. The other thing in traditional Medicare that many people purchase is called Part D, which is a pharmaceutical program, mm-hmm. that mostly protects you against large loss, against if you're on really expensive medicine.
What, Dr. Klein, are we looking at dollar and cents wise here? I mean, the big pitch, obviously, that so many people make in this campaign is, well, private health insurance may be nice, but it's so expensive, and the healthcare companies are gouging people, and this is something that should not be offered at a profit or when, you know, shareholders and stockholders are involved.
Yeah, so I think it's a problem to view it that way. In my view, this would be far more expensive because of what's proposed, but also because you would have none of the controls that private insurers bring. And so the Mercatus Center at George Mason University suggested that it would cost $32.6 to $40 trillion with a T dollars. We spent about $740 billion last year. So it would cost much, much more. I think that the concern would be much of what you're paying for when you pay for private insurance is they're acting as an intermediary and a negotiator. And yes, so they negotiate prices, but they also do have controls that try to make sure that utilization is in accordance with standard medical practice. These types of costs, I don't think you can get rid of, and I think it's a misconception to say, well, they've got all these marketing costs, for example, and we could just get rid of administrative costs and everything's going to be cheap. Well, you could make that argument about cars, mm-hmm. and you could make that argument about food, and you could make it about everything, and you could say, well, the government should provide everything, and they won't have to do any of that promotion, any of the marketing, you won't have any administrative costs, but we all know that would be completely inefficient and wouldn't work, and it's the same thing in healthcare. You have, because really what you have are other people spending other people's money. And that in the end ends up to not work, actually. It ends up to be a problem. There you tend to have very severe problems with cost control, which is what we have with current Medicare. Current Medicare is a pittance of what they're talking about. And that program is really on the verge of insolvency in its current form at current payment levels.
Dr. Roger Klein is the guest. He's a member of the Regulatory Transparency Project on Healthcare, former advisor to the FDA and HHS. He graduated from Yale Law School, did his post-grad medical training at the Yale Medical School. So, doctor, you just couldn't get enough of beautiful New Haven, could you, when you were at Yale?
No, you know, New Haven is really a wonderful place, and it's gotten much, much better over the years.
Well, my hometown, so I'm with you on that. The other thing, doctor, that I always get into with people when we discuss this is the ability to see the doctor you want when you want to see him or her, and wait times and or exclusions for certain procedures. And people I know, doctor, that wax poetic about the Canadian healthcare system and about the NHS in Britain and the UK, I say, well, fine, go online and take a look at what common procedures that you or I could get within a week or so here. Go online and see how long it takes, often into the months or maybe close to a year, to get some of that stuff done.
Yes, you're correct. Any system has to have some type of controls to prevent to restrain utilization, to restrain costs. When you say to everybody, we're going to give you anything you want for free, somebody has to restrict utilization or people are just going to come and take it. And I don't think United Americans are simply not used to or willing to accept what type of onerous restrictions this would come with. For example, they may say at a certain age you can't get a bypass. At a certain age you can't get a hip replacement. And you could wait months and months. You can wait months to see a doctor. I think people just there's a rosy picture being painted that really isn't consistent with reality, and it's certainly very different than what most Americans get today.
Dr. Klein, what would be your recommendation if you sat in front of a bunch of healthcare leaders and a bunch of members of Congress, which I know you have before, and a president and or presidents past and future, and they said, you know, Dr. Klein, what should we do here? What would be your answer to that?
Well, you know, of course, it's a big question. But the first thing we have to understand is that in its current form, the government program that we have for the elderly and disabled Medicare is not sustainable. We in order to be on a sound footing for the long term, we'd need to cut expenses today by 20%. So the program isn't working. So and the fundamental reason is because we don't have a good way of controlling spending, and we don't have a good way of controlling waste. We don't have a good way of controlling fraud or controlling abuse. And part of the reason is because the system is too heavily reliant on people spending money in which they don't have a personal stake. They're basically spending somebody else's money. The doctor's spending somebody else's money, and the patient's spending somebody else's money. And not only that, but the patient's contributed, so they have they sort of feel like, well, I put into the system, and I want to get out. And so everything pushes toward increased costs. And what we need to do is we need to back off the government control. We need to put more control in the hands of patients. And for services that can be shopped, which are many healthcare services, for shoppable services, we need to try to have people spend money over which they control and which they have a personal stake. And that would be the first principle to which I would move, is that people do better when they spend money, their own money, and want money over which they have a stake and over which they have control. And so and I think we could design a system where we would move toward, or at least voluntarily for some people, would move toward a medical savings account type model where there's money put into account for the person, and the person shops for services. That would force providers to tell you how much you're paying. I would venture to say that most listeners have no idea what they pay when there's a service.
Well, sure. And doctor, I'm so glad you brought that up. Let me give you a quick example. One of my, I had a doctor who has since retired. He was my dermatologist for a few years. And we got to talking one day, and we got to talking about, you know, medical insurance. And he told me, doctor, he said he, you know, we talked, well, he asked me about what policy I had, and we started chatting. He says, you know, he says, now this is a doctor telling me this, Dr. Klein. He said, you know, I have this so-and-so policy, and my wife passed away recently, but he goes, here's how long I've had this policy. And I said, well, how long? He goes, well, this policy is so old that I, meaning him, my old doctor, Dr. Klein, I actually had to pay the bill, and then I got a check reimbursement from the insurance company. I said, wow, that must be old. And, you know, this gentleman was in his 80s when he retired, but he said, I don't mind that. And I said, why? And he, Dr. Klein, said, because you know what? Even as a physician, it reminded me how expensive some of this stuff was when it wasn't just the insurance company writing out the check. When I had to write the check out first, he said, Dr. Klein, he said that was such a stark reminder to me that, as you say, Dr. Klein, it's a cost problem, not an insurance or a healthcare problem.
I agree with that. And again, I think you're hitting the point right on. You're hitting it right on the head. Basically, what we have is a system that's very heavily reliant on third party payments, and the people who are doing the spending have essentially no incentive to restrain costs. And quite frankly, they don't know how much things cost. Even the physician doesn't know a lot of the time. I mean, you just order something, and you really don't have any sense for what it's. The question is it covered? And maybe what's the patient's copay?
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. And I think we really, is it any wonder that healthcare costs and expenditures are rising exponentially, and they seem out of control? Anything, if we did that with anything, any subject, any commodity, if we treated it like that, the same thing would happen. It's the only thing closes or analogous is education, where we put in tons and tons of money, mm-hmm. and the costs go up and up and up and up.
And, you know, doctor, I think we tend to blind ourselves a little to that because, let's face it, when it comes to the health care and the well-being of ourselves or our mom or dad or son or daughter or, you know, girlfriend, boyfriend, husband, wife, we tend to emotionally say, well, just make them better. I don't care what it costs. They're so important to me. Just make them better. So I can almost understand, Dr. Klein, where that comes from.
Yeah, I've got to tell you, in certain circumstances, emergencies and that sort of thing, of course, you have a different attitude. But there are many services that can be shopped, and you could easily check providers. And if they told you what it costs and you had a stake in paying for it, you would go ahead and you would investigate the same. This works in plastic surgery, which has nothing approaching the type of inflation that that regular medical or LASIK surgery for eyes, for example,
yeah,
where the price has gone down with competition. What other health services have gone down in price?
No, you're right, because I do see all these, you know, not bargain LASIK, but you see, you know, LASIK for less. And I remember, doctor, when it first came out, it was, you know, several thousand dollars per eye. And a lot of folks paid out of pocket because it was, you know, an alternative to glasses or contacts. And now you're right. I mean, just in display advertising, I get on a web page, local doctors down to, in some cases, less than $1,000 per eye. So you're right. The LASIK, it has worked in that situation.
It does, because people spend their own money. So, you know, I mean, to the extent that insurance doesn't cover something, go into a drugstore and buy over-the-counter medicines. You'll have multiple choices, and you can buy the brand, you can buy the generic, you see exactly what price it is, and that's really what we need to do with many types of, you know, there are estimates that up to 50% of healthcare services can be shopped.
Roger D. Klein has been the guest. He is both a lawyer and an MD, trained in both at Yale University in New Haven. He's a member of the Regulatory Transparency Project on Healthcare, former advisor to the FDA and the Department of Health and Human Services. Dr. Klein, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much, and hopefully we can speak in the future. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. All right, there you go, folks. And he's right. You know, it's not so much a health care problem as it is a cost problem, right? I mean, listen, I've got a couple of chronic health conditions that I have to get checked for every couple times a year to make sure I'm okay. I've openly discussed with you that I'm a type 2 diabetic, but you know, one of the medications I take, for example, and, you know, thank God I'm not on insulin. My, you know, it's well controlled. I feel great. I feel the best I've felt in years. But one of my monthly medications for diabetes is $700. Now, the other one I take is about $15 a month. So my doctor and I are trying to figure out which one is actually working, right? But is there any reason my high-tech new diabetes med should cost $700? You know, roughly, it's costing me roughly $22, $23 a day if I didn't have insurance. So it's a cost problem, folks, not so much health care or the folks doing it.
Connecticut Today, WICC 600.
Yes, and we are here at WICC 600, online at WICC600.com. Welcoming back an old buddy of the program here, a guy who may have almost single-handedly scuttled tolls here in the state, at least for now. Patrick Sasser joins us from notollsct.org. Patrick, Paul here. How are you, my friend?
I'm good, Paul. How are you?
Well, what are you hearing now? Now, I've heard from a bunch of legislators up in Hartford that, you know, this whole thing with maybe a bridge-only toll or maybe reduced tolls might not even happen in a special session coming up. Are you hearing that, if anything, or not?
Well, first I have to correct you a little bit. I can't say that I've single-handedly done all this. I have to thank the tremendous amount of people across the state of Connecticut that have gotten involved in this issue, people who have volunteered their hours attending events, holding rallies. So I have to say thank you to all of them.
Sure.
But back to your comment, last I had heard from Representative Matt Ritter, who is the majority leader in the House, he was conducting an interview, and last I had heard him mention was something about the possibility of a special session before Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he didn't give any specifics, and, you know, I would be shocked if they actually brought up tolls right now. It still doesn't seem that they have the votes. I think it's clear the people of Connecticut have spoken out overwhelmingly against tolls, so I would be shocked if they did that. But, you know, we've seen crazy things happen in this state, so we're going to continue fighting this battle and making sure that we're out there and that they know we're out there, because the moment that we stop, they'll take that opportunity to try to pass something.
Yeah, and that's why I wanted to have you on, Patrick, because, yeah, I think that their hope now, Patrick, they're saying, well, let's just wait Sasser and his bunch out. And, yeah, there was 100,000 signatures, but let's try to do something when they're not paying attention here. And you're right, Patrick. I think that is the thing that we all have to be careful about here.
Absolutely. And we're actually ramping up our efforts. And I would encourage your listeners to go to our website at notollct.org and purchase a T-shirt, purchase a yard sign. Those funds that we're collecting, we're using that actually for this battle. We've gotten this far on a shoestring budget, but we're looking to ramp things up now. We're in the process of getting some billboards throughout the state of Connecticut with some messaging. We want to raise enough money to do some target mailing throughout Connecticut and some of the target districts of our state senators and state representatives. So we've got a couple things in mind, and we encourage folks, if they would be so kind as to make a contribution, spending a few dollars today can actually help save everyone several hundred dollars per year in the future if they were to put these tolls in. So it is a grassroots effort, but like anything else, it does require a little bit of money to to continue to fight this battle.
The guest is Patrick Sasser from notollct.org, and as Patrick just said, you can go to the website there and contribute a couple of bucks and get yourself a T-shirt or a lawn sign, and it will go toward the battle against tolls. And Patrick, if you can head them off and keep this thing away from a debate here in a special session or whatever, then we suddenly flip the calendar in the fall and winter into an election year, and you and I just know if they have any sense, this will never see the light of day for at least another year in 2020.
Well, that's correct, and that's really the goal here. We've made it very clear, and we're going to continue on this message. We have a slogan now that we're starting to use: vote for tolls, lose at the polls. And that's a message that we're going to carry on with, because it's time for us taxpayers to finally call our lawmakers to the mat and say, we've had enough. We are taxed to death in this state. We're the second highest tax state in the country, taxing our way through our financial problems is not the solution of fixing Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
And they need to understand that, and that's why we're making it very clear, lawmakers that are supporting tolls, who have voiced that, good luck next year, because the taxpayers are well on to you. And, we're going to make sure that every single voter knows who is supporting tolls and who's not.
And, Patrick, I've said this before, and I'll say it again to you for as long as we have to in this fight. Connecticut, as a lot of people know, does not have initiative and referendum. We cannot have direct ballot access on things, like tolls, like marijuana, like the death penalty, a lot of these socioeconomic issues. But I have to tell you, you and the folks you work with and all the people that have latched on to this, Patrick, I'll tell you right up front, I never thought that there was the gut level will in this station, in this state, to pull this off without a straight ballot initiative and or referendum. And so far, so good. You guys have done something that, at least so far, I did not think was possible.
Yeah, and I have to say, there was a lot of people that felt that same way. And I think this just hopefully proves to people that if you feel strongly about an issue, speak out. That's the only way for our voices to be heard in this state. And I'm really hopeful that this movement against tolls is a spark, and maybe this will cause others to maybe get involved in other issues and other taxes that are coming up. And, and we can just, win our state back. And that's really what the ultimate goal is here, is to save our state. People are leaving this state in droves. People are not staying here to retire. Businesses are moving. It's not a business-friendly state anymore. So when you start adding all those things together, and then you want to dump 50 to 80 tolls on top of it, it's just, you have to start wondering, who's going to be left in Connecticut to foot the bill?
Patrick, thank you, my friend. I have to run. We're up against the time-wise. Sure. Pat, great joining you. Call me if there's anything you need. Have a great rest of the summer. We'll talk to you in a few weeks. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Patrick Sasser there, the group, the organization, NoTollsCT.org. Head to the website, contribute some money. You can buy a T-shirt, a lawn sign, and tell the fine folks, the fine gentlemen and gentleladies, in all my comedy, C-O-M-I-T-Y, and my parliamentary procedure of both sides of the General Assembly, thank you, Noah, for tolls.
You're listening to Connecticut Today with Paul Pacelli on WICC 600.
And we are right here, WICC600.com, online, and WICC600 on the air. With you, it's Connecticut Today, every Monday through Friday from 2 p.m. to 6 p.m. Yours truly, like the man with the big voice said, Paul Pacelli behind the mic here, Aaron Johnson on the other side of the glass. This day, back in 1955, a day that Connecticut will never, ever forget, the nation will never, ever forget, it left a permanent scar on the state, particularly the valley, the areas of Naugatuck, Torrington, Derby, Oxford, Shelton. It was a weather disaster, never seen before that, never seen since then. Joining us right now, a buddy of mine who, back a few years ago, 2006, I think it was, produced a great documentary about the great flood, the confluence of what happened on this day back in 1955. Rich Hanley joins us. Rich, how are you, buddy?
Good. What's going on?
Well, Rich, this was a day back in 55 where the state had never seen anything before. I even think since, Rich.
No, it was unique in many ways. And as you noted in the opening, it did change the landscape of Connecticut. It accelerated plans to create flood control structures in the Naugatuck River Valley from Winsted, you know, all the way down to the Housatonic River, and the shoreline.
Yeah.
So it really changed the way Connecticut and the nation handled natural disasters as well.
What attracted you, Rich? And I remember having you on one of my older shows back when in New Haven when you were doing this. I just forgot how long it was. What attracted you to this story?
Well, it was a convergence of a couple of things. One is that we wanted to make sure that memories of the flood, you know, were captured as the people got older and their memories faded. We wanted to make sure that what happened in Connecticut in August 1955 was recorded, you know, in terms of observations by people who experienced it while their minds were still shattered in some ways by it. And two, we found all sorts of color footage of it, so it made a perfect accompaniment to those memories, is having this color footage of helicopter rescues, the flood itself as it came down from the hills in the Naugatuck River Valley, and overran community after community after community. To have that color footage alongside the stories gave it a certain potency that it would otherwise not have. And it was the 40th anniversary of the event too, and people continually use that date as a landmark of their lives. There's what happened before August 1955 and what happened after 1955. So that in and of itself is reason for a story.
Yeah, and Rich Hanley, by the way, is the guest, professor at Quinnipiac University, also producer on several documentaries, including The Great Flood of 55. Rich, briefly here, what caused that? I remember seeing your explanation of it in the film there, but it really was the confluence of a couple of storms, right, that just came together in the most deadly way they could.
Yeah, there were two hurricanes. On August 11th, Hurricane Connie came roaring in from the south and swept through the East Coast. It kind of grazed Connecticut. It didn't hit it head on, but it dumped a lot of rain, you know, 6-7 inches of rain on the state, which saturated the ground. The summer of that year had been abnormally dry until that point. So what Connie did was soften it up like a good fighter, you know, with the body blow, mm-hmm. a little jab here and there. And then the main event, the main piece of the disaster occurred on August 19th when Hurricane Diane slammed into Connecticut and dropped 20 inches of rain.
20
in a very short period.
20 inches of rain. Wow. Wow.
20 inches of rain. Yeah. So you have a ground that could not handle that sort of rain. You had ponds and lakes that couldn't handle that amount of rain in such a short period. So the water had nowhere to go but down, heading toward the ocean as water does. And in its path stood towns like Winsted, Torrington, Naugatuck, you know, Ansonia, Seymour, you know, all the way down to Bridgeport. But it also affected other areas. Out in Putnam, Connecticut.
Yeah.
In the areas along the Connecticut River are inundated by this this event. So it wasn't restricted to the Naugatuck River Valley. The most dramatic damage occurred in that path from Winsted down to Long Island Sound.
Yeah.
But Putnam, Connecticut had a great deal of damage because of it. A magnesium plant caught fire, and that added to the certain apocalyptic nature of the event.
Yeah, and Rich, I wanted to mention that because you were dealing with a different Connecticut back then. That was right, Rich, in the post-World War II Connecticut, where these big plants, these manufacturing plants, all the way from Bridgeport up north on the river, were still pretty prevalent.
Yeah, and they're active, and the transportation system wasn't as sophisticated as it is now. We didn't have the interstate highway system. We didn't have workarounds necessarily. So if you lost a main road, you lost contact with the community, and that happened. And not only did the water raging in from the north as it headed toward the sound, you know, demolish factories and homes along the way, but it also took out a lot of roads, which made it hard to get to people, and it made it hard for news of what was happening to get out as well. And it was hard for reporters to get into these towns.
Mm-hmm.
But the word got out and caught the president's attention, President Eisenhower's attention, and he flew over the area to look at the damage and to propose legislation that would help Connecticut recover.
Yeah, and that I thought was a big point of that, Rich. That I remember you brought out in the special here that the president recognized how devastating this was. A lot of times, this stuff, Rich, didn't and still doesn't really happen in the Northeast per se. I mean, there's all the flooding that happens down south and Tornado Alley in the Midwest, but this was really a body blow to the area at the time.
Right, and Eisenhower recognized how essential Connecticut was to national defense,
mm-hmm.
you know, in terms of our manufacturing capacity. It's, you know, it's important to note that Sikorsky, which is now part of Lockheed, you know, was damaged by the flood, and it made helicopters,
mm-hmm.
You know, for the Department of Defense, among other agencies. So, you know, knowing that that plant was at risk, knowing that the brass industry of Waterbury was decimated and so on and so forth, the federal government did take measures to expedite plans that already existed to build flood control structures. So the area would be protected in the event this sort of 100-year storm happened again.
64 years, Rich, it's amazing. People are still remembering it, you know, just kind of musing before we had you on here. You know, 64, you would have had to, if you were 64 now, you were an infant back then. So I'm guessing, Rich, the people with a recollection of this right now, may not be too many of them around. They would probably be, I'm guessing, probably around their mid-70s, I would think.
Right, and it's certainly that's why it was important at the time to capture the memories of people, because this is a significant event in the history of not only Connecticut but also of New England and the United States,
mm-hmm.
because it showed how vulnerable certain sections were to these storms, and how vital industries could be disrupted by the appearance of these storms and why weather forecasting is important and so on and so forth. It just underscored that even, you know, after World War II, the United States and it had to do something to protect its vital industries from natural disasters as much as it possibly could do. Mm-hmm. And the flood control technology was pretty well in place. You build the reservoir to hold the water, build dams to control the flow of it,
yep.
And you could protect these towns and whatnot. And also transportation connections. The flood showed great vulnerability when you'd have like Route 44, say, severed
yep.
by flood wars. You couldn't get medical help in there. So, and this is circling back to what I said earlier. Mm-hmm. This is where Sikorsky comes into play. Sikorsky unleashed its full fleet of helicopters.
Rich, before we had that break, you started to talk about the immediate role that Sikorsky played in all this in helping people out up and down the river.
Sikorsky, the U.S. Navy, Coast Guard, even sent helicopters throughout the Waterbury area and throughout the Naugatuck River Valley and rescued hundreds of people. You know, they plucked them off of rooftops, from tree branches, from his streets that were flooded.
Mm-hmm.
Over 500 people were rescued by helicopter. During the height of the flood, which is an extraordinary operation to have that many people rescued by what was at the time not an everyday aircraft.
Yeah.
We didn't see helicopters, but helicopters were, of course, important during the Korean War, but they weren't necessarily seen as a civilian.
No.
Artifact or a vehicle. So when Sikorsky sent its helicopters up, Navy sent its helicopters, Coast Guard sent its helicopters, it showed mm-hmm. the life-saving potential
yeah.
of the helicopter and its capacity to get to a place fast and to get to people fast and to get them out of danger. Now helicopters are essential to any sort of first response to a natural disaster of this magnitude.
Rich, if somebody wants to see this, how do they get a hold of this? Is the DVD still available? Do libraries have it? Because, I went back and I watched scenes of it today before I called you to have you on, and you probably see the same comments I see on YouTube and other sites. Oh my God, I had no idea this happened, or my grandma told me about this, and where can folks, especially a younger generation, still catch this if they want to?
Well, it's available in many public libraries
Good.
Throughout Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
And CPTV ordinarily runs this documentary, even though it's 24 years old. I mean, it still gets a huge audience whenever it's scheduled to air.
Mm-hmm.
And if you call CPTV, they may have some DVDs available nice. For sale. I'm not certain of that, but it is interesting that the ratings for that documentary are astonishing.
They're always good.
Even though it's 24 years old, people are still fascinated by it. And as you referenced, a new generation of folks who heard about it from grandparents or parents wants to see what exactly the history was all about. And when they see it, they're startled.
Yeah.
For example, when I give public presentations, and you have a younger cohort in the crowd, but younger means folks who didn't experience it or
yeah.
just heard about it.
Well, they see that torrent. Like, well, Rich, yeah. they see that torrent of water, that just battering ram of water heading down the Naugatuck River, and that's something they've never experienced.
And in today's dollars, the flood caused $2 billion worth of damage.
Wow.
It was about $200 million at the time, if you factor in inflation. It would be a $2 billion disaster. It killed 87 people. So this was a really high magnitude, a natural disaster. It's one you can see why it's seared into the memory of so many people and has caught the interest of generations who didn't experience it firsthand.
Rich Hanley. Rich, always good to talk to you, my friend. Rich, professor of communications at Quinnipiac University in Hamden. 64th anniversary today, but, 24 years ago, Rich got together and produced and released a great documentary. Check it out. One of a series of documentaries he's done on Connecticut. This one, The Flood of 1955. Rich, always good to talk to you, my friend. Thank you for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Paul, thanks for having me. It's great talking with you.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Rich Handley there, folks. Check it out. If you have any memories of that, you want to chime in here. I'm sure there are folks right here in the WICC audience who experienced that, who experienced the immediate aftermath of that. What are your memories? 203-333-9422, 203-333-WICC. And if you've never seen it, folks, or you've never seen this special, there are, like Rich said, local libraries have it. CPTV runs it all the time. They usually run it, I think, once or twice a year, along with some of the other great documentaries Rich has done. But I got to tell you, you got to see the newsreel footage. And there was a surprising amount of news footage, of course, all film back then, not videotape. But to watch that footage when that mountain of water, that just a battering ram of water, came down the Naugatuck River and just, as Rich said, caused fires in some of these riverside factories, knocked homes, houses, garages off their foundation like they were stilts, like they were mounted on stilts or matchsticks. Wild stuff.